I was going to talk about neutrinos and neutrinoless double beta decay. It's my understanding that you guys have already had actually some of the theoretical motivation about why hunting for neutrinoless double beta decay would be like an important and worthy thing to do. And that's really great, because I think that this lecture will help complement what you've heard from a much more like, you know, from the mathematical framework of setting up the motivation for looking at it. But before we get there, I thought it would be that it might be of interest to talk a little bit about the origin of the neutrino and kind of go over the history a little bit. And so the neutrino origin story sort of starts back in the 1930s when observations of beta decay itself, so not even like double beta decay, not neutrinoless double beta decay, going all the way back to the very first observations of beta decay, they sort of introduced a problem with the conservation of energy. So essentially what you had going on back then is you had this tritium atom beta decaying to helium-3. So tritium has one proton and two neutrons, and helium-3 has three protons and one neutron. So ideally, if you want to observe this, if you want to make a measurement of this, like, you would observe many, many, many beta decays. And the observed spectrum was like this, you know, exponential sort of continuous spectrum, which was unexpected. What, you know, conservation of energy would tell us, like, if you have this process, that you would have the electron coming out would have a very defined energy at one point. And even if you were measuring it and your experiment wasn't perfect, there would just be a spread of energy that you're measuring around this sort of endpoint energy. You wouldn't have, you know, this exponential behavior. And so so this was really, you know, problematic. And so it was in December of 1930, that a group of physicists convened at the Tübingen meeting in Germany to discuss the latest developments in nuclear physics. So the most logical person that you would have at this meeting at that time would have been Wolfgang Pauli. He was a young Austrian physicist, and he had made seminal contributions to the emerging field of quantum mechanics at this time. Pauli, though, had this social obligation in Zurich, so he sent a letter instead, which turns out to be one of the most important letters in the history of physics.
He used the Snow Lab letterhead, apparently.
He did use the Snow Lab header. So this is the letter, and this is the English translation of it, obviously. But he addressed the letter famously, "Dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen," and the letter contained a radical proposal to this vexing problem of conservation of energy and beta decay. It boldly suggested that there would be this new particle that's being emitted that wasn't being detected in the experiments, and he called that particle a neutron. But that's not the same neutron that we think of today. Today we know that particle to be a neutrino. So this was his suggestion. Let's see. So going back,
I thought they were massive.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, Okay, so he proposes this like new particle that's neutral and is at least as light as the neutron and would be very difficult to detect.
The actual neutron?
No, this is he is proposing a new neutral particle that's neutral is at least, yeah, so this neutron is the neutron we know today, the particle he's proposing is the particle we know as the neutrino. Actually, this is the next slide talks about this a little bit. So this particle that he's proposing can't have any electric charge. That's why he proposed calling it the neutron. It was actually Enrico Fermi that later christened the term neutrino for this particle to distinguish it from the neutron that we're otherwise confusing ourselves with right now. That's like a heavy neutron that accounts for much of the mass of your nucleus. So Pauli himself, he's very uneasy about this idea of an undetectable particle. He's actually even very self-deprecating about it, you know, calling it something that no theorist should ever do. And this is the reason why he sent that informal letter to the meeting rather than showing up himself or a formal paper about this idea. But the idea caught on very quickly, and it was particularly Fermi who picked up the work and completed a theory of nuclear decays that included the neutrino, and that happened within a few years of the Tübingen meeting. So, of course, then, you know, I've been trying to give the experimental perspective as I've been, you know, talking about underground physics in the school this year. And so, of course, I have to point out to you that the idea of an undetectable particle is the kind of thing that really nags, you know, at an experimental physicist. And so people immediately started to poke at the theory of both Pauli and Fermi to see if there might be a way to detect these things, to detect these neutrinos. You know, it's a very tricky problem because neutrinos, as we know today, they're very weakly interacting with the rest of the known particles. And so, I mean, we already know this, that indeed a solution was found. The neutrino was detected using using inverse beta decay by Cohen and Rhines, so Clyde Cohen and Frederick Rhines, in 1956. Their detector used about 200 liters of water with cadmium salts dissolved in it, and it was sort of sandwiched between layers of gamma ray detectors. And in order to get a detectable neutron or neutrino flux, they had to put the detector next to a nuclear reactor in South Carolina. And so this is a schematic of one of the modules of the setup of the Rhines and Cohen experiment. So essentially this here is your liquid. These are your photomultiplier tubes for detecting it. So you would have a beam of antineutrinos from the reactor, or I guess it's really not a beam if it's from a reactor, it's more of a flux, right? So the idea is that your antineutrino would come in, interact with a proton, give off a positron and a neutron through a capturing process with the cadmium. You would detect a gamma ray, and then the positron itself would give off gamma rays. A few details here. So the source, like I said, was this nuclear reactor in Savannah River, which is located in South Carolina. The detector was placed about 11 meters from the reactor, and it was 12 meters underground. So notice we're already doing underground physics way back in 1956. The detector chamber, like I said, is filled with 200 liters, and it had 40 kilograms of the cadmium chloride dissolved, and the neutrinos then were discovered first in 1956. I have a couple of pictures that I've pulled from some museum, so the Museum D. Curie. So this is a picture of basically they're loading up one of the modules. The modules themselves, like that I just showed you, these detector modules were kind of these located in these sort of blue areas. And so you can see, you know, there were a variety of modules. And that is a surprise. Okay. basically once the modules were all loaded up, notice that they even were doing shielding designs back then, right? These are not the types of shields that we see nowadays, but even back then you had some sort of shielding going on. All right, so that was the first detector. So kind of the next sort of thing that comes up, if you think about neutrinos and you think about underground physics, is neutrinos from the sun. So kind of going back to our history lesson. Okay, so neutrino physics has come a long way since those days of Cohen and Rhines. So the next sort of, I think, really notable experiment that historically you kind of think about is experiments done by Ray Davis and Masatoshi Kobayashi. They shared the Nobel Prize in 2002 for building detectors that can detect neutrinos. In Davis's case, the experiment was a 600-ton tank of industrial cleaning fluid that was put in a mine. And that mine was in Homestake, South Dakota. We now know that to be the Samford Underground Laboratory. And basically, like every few months, he would chemically separate a handful of argon atoms created when the neutrino was absorbed by the chlorine that was in this cleaning fluid. The Koshiba detector in the Kamioka Observatory was even bigger. It was around 50,000 tons of water, and it read out in real time as neutrinos striking nuclei in the water produced small flashes of light that were picked up by photomultiplier tubes. Sorry, I think there was one more thing I wanted to say on this slide. Let me check here. Okay, I guess not really. Okay. So going back to Davis's experiment, there was actually a problem. Davis detected only about 1/3 of the number of neutrinos that was protected by theorists, which leads you to the question, was there something wrong with the experiment or was there something wrong with the standard solar model? Does anybody know or can anybody guess what his problem was? The experiment?
Oscillations.
Oscillations, yeah. So he hadn't known about neutrino oscillations. So basically, this became why he was detecting 1/3 of the neutrinos became the standard solar, or became known as the solar neutrino problem. And so, I'll just flash this. So it was finally in the 1990s that underground experiments in both Japan and Canada vindicated Davis. It turned out neutrinos did come in three types, the electron, the muon, and the tau, as you all know. And Davis was only measuring the electron neutrinos that were produced in the sun. And so essentially then it was experiments like Super K and the SNOW experiment that measured these solar these oscillating three flavors. And the Nobel Prize in Physics then was awarded in 2015 to Kajita and to Arthur McDonald for the observation of neutrino oscillations. So I just want to make a little aside here. So this is sort of the end of our history lesson in neutrinos, but I just wanted to point out to you that, like, even from its very early days of conception of what's going on and the idea that the neutrino is there in its very first measurement, doing underground physics was already a part of what we were doing. We didn't have laboratories like SNOW Lab or Gran Sasso or the Sanford Lab in the US at that time, but we still were doing underground physics. And so the one thing I wanted to say about these experiments too that I think is a good point to make, and just before we jump into neutrinoless double beta decay, is that I think all of these experiments, for the most part, especially the later ones, there's a bit of serendipity that comes into play when it is that you're discovering new physics. And so I think we all have to always be prepared for the unexpected. So the CAMLAND, or the Kamioka and Super K experiments, and another one, IBM, which was another one of these water Cherenkov detectors, they were all designed to actually look for proton decay, which we haven't seen yet. And it wasn't, these detectors were built to do one thing, And then it was realized that we could do something different with them, right? And so it was once we started using them then for neutrino detectors that we started observing things like solar neutrinos. Again, that's the Kashiba Nobel Prize. And experiments like Snow Plus and Super K that were proving oscillations. So I think, you know, like being prepared for the unexpected is always something that we need to do. And to be honest, it makes my favorite Nobel Prize stories. Like, I was a graduate student who was supposed to go off and I was gonna do this other great measurement and my apparatus was broken. So my advisor made me do this other measurement. And this other side measurement turns out to be the lamp-breaking physics. That's actually Doug Osheroff's Nobel Prize story. So if you don't know about his Nobel Prize, I encourage you to look him up online. All right, so with that, on to neutrinoless double beta decay. So I am going to not go into a great detail, certainly not the way I did with dark matter when it comes to this neutrinoless double beta decay. And I'm not going to go through a real formal theory. If you're interested in learning more and going through the formal theory in a bit stronger way, these are sort of three different references that I would recommend, and they will be in the slides that go that I put online. But before we get to neutrinoless double beta decay, let's start thinking about just plain old double beta decay, okay? So it's the Pauli exclusion principle that results in the idea that even nuclei paired spins want to be in lower energy states, right? They want to be in the lowest energy spins possible. So that means that for certain nuclei with even numbers of both protons and neutrons, so when people say even or odd, that's what they mean, even numbers of protons, even numbers of neutrons, it turns out that single beta decay is not allowed by the conservation of momentum. So these nuclei can only double beta decay. And that was something that was proposed in 1935 by Maria Goeppert-Mayer. So this double beta decay is a second order weak process. It has a half-life of something like 10 to the 19 to 10 to the 21 years. It's a very long-lived process that was first observed in 1987 by the Michael Moe group. And basically, in the standard models, when this happens, two electrons and two antineutrinos are emitted. So here's just kind of a rough formula. And here's like your neutron going into, going into a proton and getting your beta decay. And so in this, like what you can see is that everything works, right? Lepton number is conserved, things are working great. But if it happens that neutrinos are Majorana, then neutrinoless double beta decay can occur. And there are a variety of mechanisms through which this could happen. This is illustrating the exchange of a light neutrino, but there are other possibilities that could occur. And what you notice is that when this occurs, lepton number is violated. So lepton number conservation is violated. So you might think, kind of, what does this look like? So again, this is our just double beta decay, neutrinoless double beta decay. So this two neutrino double decay is allowed in some isotopes and it produces this sort of peak. If the neutrinos are Majorana processes and you can have neutrinoless double beta decay, this is what you're gonna see. So it's pretty small. So already you're seeing from this plot here, there's this indication that this is a very rare process. And so right away that makes you want to write down a rate equation and start digging into the details. All right, so let's just assume that you have this light Majorana neutrino exchange going on. If that is happening, then your rate is essentially equal to your half-life. And so that is equal to a phase factor for two neutrino emission, a matrix element, and then this term M beta beta. So just gonna step through each of these. So this M beta beta is a matrix element, and it's equal to the sum of MI times U EI squared, where these are just your standard elements for neutrino mixing, right? So what you see here, like these are the types of elements and what you're measuring when you're measuring, when you're trying to do your neutrino oscillation measurements and stuff, right? This matrix becomes important. And so the MIs here are the Majorana mass of your individual eigenstates, and the UIEs are the components of the neutrino mixing matrix. And so what you can see is even under the simple assumptions, neutrinoless double beta decay depends on the mixing angles. It depends on how much CP violation you're having in the neutrino sector. That's what this delta CP is. It depends on the neutrino masses. It depends on the mass hierarchy. And it depends on two totally unknown phases. Looking at this other term, sort of just breaking this down. So G0 neutrino, this is, like I said, the phase factor for the emission of two electrons. So this phase factor is essentially the difference between the initial and final energy and momentum. It scales with the Q value. So you may know what the Q value is. So it's the kinematic energy, right? Or kinetic energy released in the process, right? The energy that you're seeing. Okay, and so the G factor actually scales, like I think it's Q to the fifth, if I remember correctly. So essentially having a higher Q value gives you a higher rate. So this half-life here and this here, this is what, I mean, sorry. So T, the half-life, that's what experiments are measuring. And M beta beta is the physics that we're trying to extract. And then finally, we didn't talk about this here. Matrix element. This is a nuclear matrix element. So we were looking at the particle matrix or the particle, sort of the particle physics before. And now what we're doing is we're looking at the nuclear matrix elements. So this is basically how the nuclear decay occurs. So it takes into account the states of the nucleons, takes into account their shape, and those sorts of factors. This M squared, this nuclear matrix element, is something that is completely theoretically derived. It's not something you can measure. It's something that you have to get from nuclear theory. They essentially are translating between what it is you measure and what is M beta beta. And they're used to compare experiments using different isotopes. These nuclei, they can't be calculated in every model. These models can't make calculations for every nucleus. There are some nuclei of interest that just can't be modeled. And all of the models leave out important physics. The uncertainties in these matrix elements can be hard or impossible to quantify. And so the situation in general with these elements is improving. But this plot here, so this is M for different nuclei with different atomic numbers. You can see that there's quite a spread, even for these sort of five commonly thought about models. So there's this uncertainty that you also have to contend with when you're thinking about these experiments. So the rate depends on mixing angles. It depends on neutrino mass, and it depends on the mass hierarchy. And uncertainties in the lightest neutrino mass, phase, and hierarchy are all things you have to take into account. So this plot here basically illustrates, again, this is the mass. This is m beta beta. And this here is the lightest neutrino mass. So this is a plot you'll often see. The sensitivity of current neutrino-less double beta decay experiments basically goes to this level. So everything above that dotted line is sort of excluded by current experiments. So I'll be talking and talking a little bit about ton scale experiments. This is the experiments that are currently like in a development and a concept phase right now. The goal of them is to reach the bottom of the inverted hierarchy mass scale. If you wanted to start, you know, say exploring the normal hierarchy, you need an experiment that's like essentially 100 tons in scale, if you can scale it. And there are a lot of challenges to building these types of experiments, which we'll talk about a little bit. But the biggest challenge is the fact that neutrinoless double beta decay is very rare. So the question is how rare is rare? All right, so let me ask a question. How long does it take half the atoms to decay? Yeah, so that's a half-life. Does anybody know what the current sort of half-life for neutrinoless double beta decay is sort of at? 10 to the some number of years? How many people think it's more than 10 to the 10? 10 to the 15? Not commit, no, 10, more than 10 to the 20. More than 10 to the 25. More than 10 to the 30. 10 to the 33. Years. These are years, by the way, yeah. 10 to the 33 years, I think. Yeah, I think that it might be. Anyway, I have picked something conservative. Let's just think about this. Like, we're talking like most people are believing, from my survey here, between 10 to the 25 and 10 to the 30 years, I don't think, or maybe even 10 to the 35 years in a couple of cases. So, you know, let's just put this in perspective. What's the age of the universe?
13.
Yeah, so 10 to the 10 years. So it's like 14 billion years, right? Okay, so that's 10 to the 10. So we're already two or three times like bigger than the universe. Does anybody know what the half-life for two neutrino double beta decay? So not neutrinoless, but two neutrino.
You had it on the previous slide.
I did.
10 to the 21.
Yeah, okay. So we'll just call that 10 to the 20. Okay, great. So let's just, for sake of argument, say that neutrinoless double beta decay has a half-life that's greater than 10 to the 26 years. I think everybody agreed on that, and some people went even higher. All right, so what do we need to do this calculation? So I'm going to ask, you know, essentially, how long would we have to wait for, like, one atom to decay? So we would need Avogadro's number to calculate that out. It's 6 times 10 to the 23 years. So let's put this a little bit in perspective. So if I had, with those numbers, just kind of doing a rough calculation off the top of my head, if I had 50 kilograms of atoms, okay, and Avogadro's number is like 10 to the 23 nucleons per gram, I'd take 50 times 10 to the 3 grams, multiply it, and get something like, you know, 50 times 10 to the 26 nucleons. A mean lifetime, so let's just use the mean lifetime for a single decay, something like 1.44 times the half-life. So we'll just call that the half-life for our scaling. So that essentially means that if I watched 50 kilograms of atoms for five, of an right, of atoms for 5 years, I'd see one decay for a half, I would see one decay in that time, assuming that, you know, the half-life of this neutrinos double beta decay was 10 to the 26 years. Okay. I mean, so the reason that this exercise can kind of be useful, and I know it's a bit hand-wavy, and you could do something more precise and calculate it better out, but it at least gives you like the scale of just doing a back of an envelope calculation of what you need in terms of size if you're doing this. So obviously, we're not just gonna sit and wait for one. Like you just build, you get a lot of atoms together and you build something big. So I think that feeds well into our experimental considerations. We're gonna end really early today. We are just whipping through my slides fast. All right, so how do you detect neutrinoless double beta decay? So if you're thinking about how is it that you detect two neutrino beta-beta decay, it's a standard model process whereby you get two electrons out and some missing energy. So you're not really detecting the neutrinos directly. Right, you're just kind of looking for missing energy. If you're looking at neutrinoless double beta decay in a Majorana case, the problem you have is that there is no missing energy. Okay, so that's why in the two neutrino case, you have this sort of broad spectrum of results that you potentially could get for any individual measurement that you made. It's because you're looking at missing energy. Where in here, there is no missing energy, and so you'll get something very, very fine at an endpoint. All right, so some of our design considerations. Some of these considerations are actually considerations that take us right back to what we were thinking about in dark matter, right? It's a rare process. So if we want to see one atom out of every 10 to the 26 decays or more, we need a very high efficiency. We need very low backgrounds. We need the best possible energy resolution that we can get. And we need the ability to verify a signal candidate and that signal candidate has sort of the right properties to be that of neutrinoless double beta decay. And so, to do this, we use lessons from other rare event searches, including previous neutrino searches, searches for dark matter. We go underground to reduce the cosmic ray-induced backgrounds, just like we did for when we were talking about dark matter. We use active and passive shielding, just like we do for dark matter. We select radiopure materials in the design construction of the experiment, and we're very careful about the handling of those materials, just like we do for dark matter. And finally, just like in dark matter, it helps if you can distinguish your signal from your background so that you have some kind of like way to tag, if you will, a signal event. So I think this is, in many ways, interesting, right? So I started my career working on the AMANDA project, where we had this vast background of stuff that weren't the neutrinos we were looking for from astrophysical sources, and you know, trying to pluck a signal, a rare signal out of a big background. I went into dark matter, and again, it was trying to pluck a rare signal out of an overwhelming amount of background and coming up with techniques. And here we are again doing another type of physics where the same thing is going on. You're trying to pick out this rare signal from a really, really big background. And unlike in collider physics, where you can take your beam and you can get a lot of events really fast, right, by just colliding a lot, when you're looking for these types of, whether it be astrophysical neutrinos, whether it be neutrinos from neutrinoless double beta decay, whether it be dark matter, you're just stuck with the signal that Mother Nature gives you, right? You can't create that signal in a lab in any way. I can't. As sometimes I hear from people working in collider physics, like that they're making like little big bangs, you know, every every few nanoseconds as they collide the particles together to see what is happening. We don't get to do that in this case. I like this plot, and it actually reminds me of a plot that somebody was showing me this past week while I was here, when they were talking about dark matter and trying to detect dark matter with those CCC detectors that we had talked about, the DOMIC, Oscura, and Sensei program. And the idea that as a theorist, oftentimes you just make a no background, like perfect, there's no backgrounds at all. This is like a perfect, you know, and my sensitivity is X, right? But if you start taking backgrounds into account, it changes things. And so I find plots like this can be really instructive. So this one came from Jason Detweller. And again, here we're plotting the half-life. And so this is like three sigma discovery of the half-life. So as you go up higher here, the process is becoming more rare. And this is your exposure in 10 years. So this is how big is your detector and how long you're running it. So more exposure on this line. And so this here, 10 to the 28, this is sort of the target region when this plot was made. Like, let's say you want to be sensitive to a half-life, so a three sigma discovery, which is different than setting just a limit. Like, what would you have to do for a three sigma discovery? For a limit, they would probably become even more aware. They would be higher, as far higher on this plot in terms of, which is a smaller number. So this is it. So you kind of draw your line here. So that's what this bar is indicating. So if you're doing an experiment and you assume that it's background free, okay, in this example, this line here indicates how your sensitivity goes as a function of exposure. So you would be sensitive to everything or essentially be able to exclude things that are below this line, right? So these are shorter half-lives below the line. Now, let's say that in your region of interest, where it is that you think the dark matter is going, or the neutrinos double beta decay is going to peak, let's say that you have a background of 0.1 counts in that region each ton year that you run the experiment. That means, so you start out like this, that means that as time goes on, you become less and less sensitive, and now you can only exclude the regions under this line, right? So now let's just say that you had one count that was a background particle in a ton year of exposure. In that case, you're looking at this dashed dotted line. Again, okay, for very long exposures, you're still able to access this region, right? Now, and exclude that region. But now let's say that you have 10 counts in your region of interest per ton year. Look at this. I mean, you're going to be running your experiment a really long time and flatten it out. So this like really shows you how the backgrounds can really like mess up any plan you have for making a discovery. Any questions on this plot? The box here is just trying to show that, like, let's say that you take an experiment that is going to have 10 ton years of exposure, just the difference that you could have in, you know, accessing, going between 0.1, I mean, background free is probably really not so realistic for any experiment, but going between, say, 0.1 counts and 10 counts per year. So this is, that's a lot. Okay, so the other thing that you might want to think about is the experiment techniques for measuring the electrons that you get from 2-beta-beta decay, or that you would get out of even neutrinoless double beta decay. Essentially, you're looking at spectroscopy, right? You're looking for a peak. And tracking is the other sort of technique that you might have if you're able to track the electrons in your detector. I think that's it. And this actually should say neutrinoless double beta decay. So you're looking either for the peak, you're looking for that peak, and so you want good energy resolution, or you want to be able to reconstruct your event to topology. We already talked about the Q value. The Q value actually depends on your isotope target. The number of events you're getting looks at this is based on this formula here. All right, so when you're looking at your target, there's a couple of things that that you want to look at. So one is okay, this is the Q value, right? So having a high Q value can be something that's really, really nice. But if you have something that has a really, really high Q value but isn't very abundant, then you have another problem. So the Q value might be high, but that means that you need an awful lot of this, or else you have to enrich the isotope, that the crystal or whatever, or the liquid that you're using. You'd have to enrich it with the isotope that you're interested in order to get enough of the atoms that you're trying to detect the decay in. Does that make sense? And so, so basically, how do you increase the likelihood of measuring your event? You either pick an abundant isotope or you enrich your isotope. And enriching your isotope, and this is just an aside for now, is starting to become a lot more difficult because a lot of the enrichment of these isotopes has historically been done where? In Russia. So currently one of the things that's happening is people are looking for alternate places or alternate sources for their enriched targets. There's another issue that you have to look for too. So as far as experimental considerations and thinking about your target that I haven't, you know, put up here explicitly on the slide, can anybody think of something other than the fact like enriching becomes harder because Russia had done most of the enriching? Let's say you get past that problem. What other problem might you think is coming up that's hard and has to be planned for experiments of massive scales?
Shortage of food?
Yeah, shortages. So think about it. If you're building like a 50-ton, you know, xenon dark matter detector, and you're also going to build, I know someone from in here is on Nexo. I forget, how big is the Nexo target supposed to be in terms of xenon? I forget the exact number.
5 tons of xenon 136, or it's 5 tons of xenon enriched to 90% in 136.
Yeah.
So 45 tons, we need to buy 45 tons.
Yeah. So we now need 100 tons of xenon to do two experiments. And then if you add another experiment on, let's say that the Panda X ton program moves forward, is also very large. So you start to see how, as physicists, it's possible that we alone could drive up the xenon market, or that we could run out of abundance. I don't remember the exact number of what the production for xenon per year right now is worldwide, but this is something that like people are seriously looking at, because you could align things in such a way that you cause a shortage, and you cause each experiment inadvertently causes a drive up even in the price of, say, xenon that you need, and then that drives up the price of the experiments, makes it harder to get them done and get them funded. So sort of a crazy thing that you might not think about when you're building an experiment, but someday you guys may be building massive experiments. These are things you will get to think about too.
You're saying buy xenon futures, you're saying.
I don't know. I guess that depends if you think that every experiment will get funded and be happening at the same time or not. Okay, so the next thing I was going to talk about briefly was the importance of the Q values. So like I said, I think it is about Q to the 5 that the scales, your half-life scales. So that gives a significant boost to detector mediums with large Qs. So just kind of thinking about the Q value and why you want a large Q value is, so a piece of information that's good to know is that most radioactive backgrounds have energies that are less than 2.6 MeV. So 2.6 MeV is the energy of the 208 tallium line that comes from a thorium decay. So just taking a look at these plots, both of these plots come from the EXO-200 experiment. This is phase one and phase two, so it's two different phases of the detector. But what I want to point out here is that on this plot, again, this here is just basically counts on this axis. And on this axis here is the energy that is released. So the Q value in this case, like for xenon is, did I write it down? It's 2.459, right? Which is just below that thallium. So this is your signal here. So you see a little bit of a spread around the 2.4 line, which is what you would expect because it's not a perfect detector. And then modeled here are all different backgrounds and their data. So you can see that, okay, so this here is it. So you can see like thorium 232 kind of really overwhelms your signal region. You also have this uranium 238 also really highly overlapping with your region. You start to see the problem here, right? If your backgrounds are too big. So EXO-200 was background limited in the sense that they did actually produce really nice world-leading results despite the fact that they had these background challenges. But you can see what this means is if you're thinking about doing a next generation experiment, you need to be able to do more than perhaps just count around here. You have to get your backgrounds down so that you can see the signal over whatever your background is. If you're just scaling your detector and not addressing your backgrounds at the same time, you really don't gain anything in terms of discovery potential. I see confused faces at this plot. Is there any questions about it or its interpretation? All right. So one of the advantages, detectors is being able to like have some kind of signature of different types of events in your detector so you can do rejection. Much in the same way that in the dark matter experiments we talked about electron recoils versus nuclear recoils, like sort of event topology here is what you're looking for. So in these sorts of detectors, different types of interactions have different types of signatures. Just like in dark matter, electron or gamma rays, betas, muons, they interact with the electrons. Alphas, neutrinos, neutrons, they scatter off nuclei. And so your cosmic muon background or your internal beta background, so this is often going to, you know, kind of multiply scatter perhaps in your detector if it's big enough. And you're going to see signatures maybe coming in a downward direction. You can see neutrons and neutrinos, will make one kind of signature. Alpha backgrounds, these are due mostly to surface events. They usually will happen within 10 micrometers of your of the surface of your detector. Gamma backgrounds, multiple scatter, and so you can get rid of them that way. If you have two electron beta decay, so beta-beta decay, again, you're going to get like a multiple scatter happening within a shorter period of time. And so you can use these topologies to suppress backgrounds, you know, based on the event topology. You can use time coincidence information. You could use surface bulk discrimination. You could use any of these sort of techniques of seeing events tied in coincidence to something like an active muon veto system. Ultimately, I mean, like NEXO, EXO, these sorts of experiments, the next experiment is another one using xenon. There's even an idea of tagging a daughter atom using a variety of techniques and identifying it. All right, so moving on from that, let me talk a little bit about the experimental landscape, just sort of in a nutshell. So this is the current experimental landscape for neutrinoless double beta decay. and where things are. And so this is talking about experiments that are either operating, under construction, being commissioning, are being proposed, are sort of at a prototype level. This is a list that was compiled by scientists who are putting together a long-range plan for nuclear physics in the United States. And so I stole it directly from their paper because I don't, like, I think the point is that this is clearly an area of deep interest. You can see that almost all of the different types of isotopes I talked about, from calcium to germanium, thallium, molybdenum, cadmium, tellurium, xenon, they're all sort of listed in here. Things that are under development or still in a proposal state would not actually have a place associated with them. In the US, they do not know how to spell Snow Lab. It's all capital, by the way. And that will be on the test. but there's a lot going on here. And so clearly, I can't cover every single one of these detectors. But there's a lot, if you're interested, you can look up. So what I'm going to do instead is just kind of divide this into to talk just very generically about the experimental techniques and their advantages and disadvantages. So all of these experiments can essentially be classified into one of two types. Either you have a granular detector, and so if you're thinking about this would be a detector where you have lots of detectors that make up the whole experiment. So think of LEGEN. LEGEN is a lot of germanium detectors that are stacked together, each looking out. In the dark matter world, Super CDMS, CREST, Edelweiss, DOMIC, SENSEI, OSCURA, those types of detectors would be considered granular. In the neutrinoless double beta decay world, these are essentially bolometers and semiconductors. So you have LEGEND and CUPID if you're looking forward to this next generation ton scale experiments. The advantage of these detectors is that these detectors are essentially the same detectors you use to actually count backgrounds. Like if I was counting a background in a detector, a germanium crystal with a bolometer sort of, I don't want to say slapped on the top, but put on the top, essentially, and then lots of clean materials around it, essentially this becomes my high priority germanium counter. So these things, these detectors, they have really great energy resolution. So finding that peak and having a really nice tall peak, that's what they can do. The other advantage of a detector that's granular like this is that you can stage it. So you could imagine deploying, I don't know, 3 or 4 towers or strings of detector while you're still developing the next 4 that go in. So you can stage the development, be taking data with a smaller subset of the detectors while you're fabricating the remainder of the experiment, take a pause, you know, so you could then do, you know, maybe half the detector, 3/4, and then full. The other sort of category of detectors are what we would call monolithic detectors. And so here you would have just some big, your substrate would be one big giant, usually I would say balloon or vat of liquid or gas. And then that is read out maybe with something like photosensors. And so these tend to be scintillators and TPCs. So Nexo, Camlan Zen, Snow Plus, Next. These sorts of experiments are classified as monolithic. The advantages here, again, notice that this comes up again, this idea of self-shielding. Remember when we talked about the xenon dark matter experiments, argon dark matter experiments, as being self-shielding? If I look in the center, it's mostly going to be where your signals are residing. The same thing applies to these neutrinoless double beta decay detectors. They're self-shielding. There's also a sense that they're easier to scale because you're not individually having to fabricate lots of smaller detectors. You just have one large detector. That, of course, introduces new problems as you're trying to read out small signals in very, very large monolithic detectors. But to some extent, it does perhaps make the scalability a little bit easier. All right, so I was just going to go into a little bit of depth, but not too much, into both Legend and Nexo, since these are the two sort of really ton-scale experiments that are, there's a lot of talk and motivation now to move into the future. So Legend is a point, you start with like, you have a point contact detector. So basically this is a piece of germanium, and then it has a point, you put a point contact here where you would have your bolometer. You mount the detector to something that's low in mass. These mounts, then these detectors are then put together into a string, okay? And then that string is instrumented into an array. That whole array, once this instrument is then put into a liquid argon cryostat to cool it down. So these detectors work at, remember, very cold temperatures. And then this cryostat itself is put into a water shield that acts also as a muon veto. So that's the basic building it up. So the point is that the point contact detectors can give you a little bit of event topology and fiducialization. So this means that you can discriminate events that might be on the surface that are like your alphas that could be contaminating your signal region. And their energy resolution is like 0.1%, which is very good. The problem, so one of the things, I think I didn't point this out enough. So one of the backgrounds that's unique to these neutrinoless double beta decay experiments is the double beta decay background, right? You have this big, long double beta decay background. Depending on what your Q values are, you can, that can overlap with your signal region, depending on what you have. And so, so being able to tag any double beta decay event is really important to help reduce your background. And so the different techniques they have them for getting handles on their background are pulse shape discrimination, when they have sort of events that are happening in multiple sites. You could have germanium detector anti-coincidence, so events that are not happening in coincidence with each other are, you know, less likely to be a background. You could have a scintillating PEM plate. I don't even know what that means, but liquid argon veto based on argon scintillation light that's all read out by fibers and PMTs. So this is your and then you have this muon veto based on Cherenkov light. So it's a pretty nice detector. Nexo is, so that's an example of a detector that is granulated. Nexo is an example of a monolithic detector. So this is a TPC with 5,000 kilograms of 90% enriched xenon-136. They use SIPMs to collect the scintillation light, and they have charged tiles that can collect ionization signal as well. Similar to Legend, they also have a muon veto shield that surrounds the entire detector and layers of passive shielding. It will require a low intrinsic background in the xenon itself. They do get the self-shielding. Their energy resolution is 0.8% at the beta-beta. So you can see that their energy resolution is still good, but it's less, or it's not as good as what you would get from like the germanium detector, where it's 0.1%. And they're intending to put it in Snow Lab. All right, so.
Where is Legend?
Huh?
Where is Legend?
Okay, so. There has been a recent change. So as of a couple of months ago, both Legend and Nexo had Snow Lab as their base design for the future. Recently, Legend has changed their, I think they may have officially changed their baseline design to be at Grand Sasso. The real answer is that no decision has been made about where each experiment will be located. There's a general sentiment that there was recently a summit on the next generation neutrinoless double beta decay detectors at Snow Lab. The readout from the closed sessions or in-camera sessions at that meeting indicated that the people who attended that meeting and the funding agencies that were represented there agreed that in principle, one ton scale detector should be located in North America and one ton scale detector should be located in Europe. So the reason that I put Nexo here, you know, talks about Snow Lab is because this is the Nexo, you know, official line that they want to go to Snow Lab. And at this point, no decision about the location of any experiment, I think except Cupid, is known. I suspect within a year, official site selection will have happened.
Is there?
So I say you can read into it what you want, right? Like in Canada, most of the scientists in Canada who are working on these 10 scale programs are working on Nexo. In the US, scientists are split between Nexo and Legend. In Europe, most scientists who are working on this program are working on Legend.
Is there, so if you compare dark matter to double beta decay, do they equally prefer to be deep, or is there kind of a premium for one of them to be deeper than the other?
So I think the reason that the original like baseline design for both Legend and Nexo was Snow Lab was because the depth. We are deeper than Grand Sasso and it could work. I think as Legend has been working through their designs and the various politics that go along with hosting such a detector, they realized that they could get acceptable backgrounds with additional passive shielding that's deployed in, you know, a certain way. So, and I think Nexo had, when they were looking at various sites, had determined that it was difficult to get to the science reach they wanted to in Grand Sasso. I think, and Legend kind of indicated they thought it might be possible. If that would be, that would be what I can officially tell you. Yes.
What's Theta, and why does it have such a large sensitivity exposure relative to Legend?
I have not gotten here yet. So Theta, okay. So let's see here. I forget. I have to be honest. I have to go back and look at what Theta, where Theta is. Does anybody in the room know where Theta is proposed to be located? Because I know. Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember the origin of Theta. I apologize. Probably a quick Google search can tell you though. As we wait with bated breath. It's funny, you know, I tell my students this all the time, like they ask me questions and stuff, and I'm like, you know, I don't remember exactly what, you know, the gravitational constant is out to 5 significant digits. Why don't you look it up? You have a device. It can tell you facts like that. But anyway, let me, while you're looking that up, and hopefully it comes, so this is, again, just kind of giving an overview of the discovery sensitivities for current and next generation nutrients double beta decay experiments. So this is your M beta beta versus the sensitivity exposure in mole years. And so you can see this is the current generation. So Majorana, Camlan, Zen, this Gerda, the second incarnation of Gerda, Nexo 200. This is where they are. The bars here are indicating, they're indicating that theoretical uncertainty. So it's like taking into account some of those nuclear matrices that factors that I was talking about to kind of give you a sense of how much the theory adds to your error on your measurement of M beta beta. So it's sort of current generation experiments that are being built. Next 100, Super NEMO, Panda X, the LZ experiment. So the dark matter experiment, Lex Zeppelin, is also trying to do a measurement. Amore is a Korean experiment. Corey's in here, Snow Plus, Legend 200. All of these are sort of coming online. And you'll notice that Darwin, LZ if you enrich the xenon. So these dark matter experiments that are large, you know, sort of vats of xenon are also realizing that even when they're not enriched, there's still enough xenon there with the current level of understanding and the current limits that exist, they could contribute to an interesting result while we are working on building like Legend 1000 and Nexo. Thea is further out, but these, I think, I don't remember which countries are involved in Thea.
Thea is at Dune.
Dune? Ah, yes, that's right. I remember that. So, and so again, you would have a xenon detector or a tellurium detector. And I'm not sure, so it's interesting. So tellurium can kind of be two ways. You can do, so previously, where are they? Core were tellurium detectors, and it was a crystal. But Snow Plus is liquid scintillator that they're working to dissolve essentially tellurium in is a monolithic. So tellurium is an interesting case because you have sort of the granular results coming from Core, but then you have Snow Plus, which is trying to do some difficult chemistry. I think the chemistry itself is not difficult. Doing it on the scale of what you need in order to make a very large monolithic detector is hard, but that's what Snow Plus is trying to do. So again, a different target. Right, so any questions on this? All right, so this brings me to my conclusions. So I think there exists a very rich program of underground science that's being done in Canada and really all over the world. The worldwide dark matter program is expansive. And I think the next decade is going to be very exciting as collaborations start reporting results on existing experiments, including the Generation 2 experiments. And then as planning is getting underway to build an even larger set of Generation 3 dark matter experiments and all these experiments that we're developing to go towards lower masses. The neutrinos double beta decay program is very active. I wasn't able to capture it quite in the same amount of detail as I did with neutrinos or as I did the dark matter program. But I hope, at least with my table that I included, that you get a sense of the scale and excitement that scientists have also around neutrinos double beta decay. There is a planning process that's going on for a ton scale program that is global and that uses multiple isotopes. All right, so the idea, not one ton scale experiment, but that we can have multiple ton scale experiments with multiple isotopes because it's important to have the different targets. And so finally, I'd just like to say personally, I'd like to thank you all for really interesting discussions that we've had over lunches, dinners, and sometimes breakfast, and that you guys have been a really great class, so I really appreciate it. And I hope to see all of you at Snow Lob sometime soon. Thank you.